Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter, and I just want to let you know that if you're a Wing Chun practitioner, especially from the WT or Leung Ting line, and you want to get really personalized intensive private training with me, you can now apply to do an immersion course with me here in NYC, or if you like the sun, in my Florida home near Orlando. These courses are for instructors or anyone who's serious about learning the art in detail and working hard. I teach in program blocks like Siunam Tao, Chum Kyu, Biu Chi, and Wooden Dummy, and those include the Chi Sao Theory, fighting applications, and training methods as well. If you're really serious about learning Wing Chun, check out the link in the description below to find out about applying for a spot. And while you're here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube, like this video, and share it on your social media platforms. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of nudity, lots of, I'm Sherlock Yip. Did you pay your taxes, baby? Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
Sifu, I'm Gooch Lizzie.
Fantastic. So here we are.
We're back.
With another AMA, but soon, because I know people like the AMAs because they have a chance to ask questions and we have a wide variety. But people also want me to, like, you know, do a couple episodes on specific topics. So I think we're going to
switch it up a bit.
Yeah, switch it up a bit. Maybe an upcoming episode we'll finish the Alex Ben Block interview.
Mm-hmm.
I also think we should do the Pierre Burton interview with Bruce Lee, because that's kind of the classic one,
the
so-called lost interview.
Yeah.
And I just feel that one's been beaten to death because everyone's like, oh, be water or whatever. It's like,
of course, but
the millionth time you've heard that, you're like, I get it.
We got to bring the KFG spin on it.
We got to do the KFG spins. Yeah. We got to finish Alex Ben Block. We'll do the Pierre Burton one. I think I want to do one about the the Ip Man movies, where we can maybe do a review. We can talk about the different Ip Man movies.
All right.
And then maybe we can rate which Ip Man movies are best.
I think we should tackle that. Is that for the subscribers?
No, that'll be a regular episode. Yeah. But for our Patreon supporters, we can do some commentaries and things like that. So anyway, so let's get to it. AMAs.
All right. First up, we got Stealth Baller or Stealth Baller.
Pretty sure it's going to be Baller, isn't it?
I hope so.
He's a Stealth Baller.
He's a baller
in his mind.
All right. Would be cool to have one or more of the authors Benjamin N. Judkins and John Nielsen, who wrote The Creation of Wing Chun, on the podcast.
Is that a question?
I think it's a
Did you even screen
statement?
Did you even screen these? All right.
It's a statement.
This has to go through management. When we book guests on the show, that's got to go through the management department.
Would it be cool?
Would it be cool? So I've read the Ben Judkin's book, The Creation of Wing Chun, which is a pretty academic take on the history of Wing Chun, kind of dispelling some myths and stuff. I think it's a great book. I read it. It's a little dry, so I think you got to be like a real geek to want to kind of go through it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of really great points in the book. It's done from a very academic perspective, so you cannot knock the book for its attempts at academic honesty. I
love academic honesty.
Yeah. The issue is, like, I think the stuff about the history of Wing Chun in general is as well researched as you can get. Two issues with the book. Some of the stuff, when they actually talk about the more modern history on the Yip Man side of things, that information is very clearly not as well sourced as some of the older stuff. So there's some factual inaccuracies about some of the Yip Man, like the more current stuff is a little bit off. And there's some assumptions in there, which I go that it's not quite as academic as the older stuff, right? The book is a little bit dry, and I just have the feeling, although it's not necessary when you write an academic book, that the author, can speak Chinese or knows the Chinese source language. But I think that if you're a Westerner, mm-hmm, that is going to approach this kind of topic, I think you should know Chinese. And the book, and it's a great book. And if anyone, you know, I highly recommend people who are very interested in the history of Wing Chun to read it. But it comes off as someone like, this has been my whole life since I was 8 years old, and especially Wing Chun stuff since at least 14, 15. It comes off a little bit as a book about how to have sex written by someone who hasn't had sex. So it's very academic. It's sourced. It's all in there. But you have a feeling like,
yeah,
it's different when you talk to someone like Jim Rosalando, who's been over there and can tell you, like, you know, the plain Jane history, but can also tell you some of these other more richer stories in there and can give a little deeper context. So it does come off a little bit dry. Of course, if these guys want to be on the podcast, that's great. But I think, you know, I literally had the only African-American to ever be in the Hong Kong Stunt Association on this podcast. He lived with Sammo Hung, and that is like the least watched one. The dude is in Hong Kong movies.
Man.
Watch the Bobby Samuels episode. Right. It's freaking amazing. And there's clips in there, right?
Shout out to my man Bobby Samuels, so, like, by the way.
And that dude is amazing. Bobby Samuels is awesome, right? And the other guests we've had, a lot of people watch it because it's John Little, you know, because of the Bruce Lee thing, and Matt Polly, right? So the guests we've had, like, if they're Bruce Lee related, do really, really well. I literally had a movie star on here, and it's like, you know, like chirping crickets on that one. So I don't think, like, you know what's going to get us a lot of views? Ben Judkins. All right? No offense to Ben Judkins. It's just like, in terms of people watching it or interesting conversations, I don't know if that's the hot ticket. So, but anyway.
Gotcha. All right. Next up, we got Fernando Nunez.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any little known Yip Man stories that you have heard?
Little known Yip Man little stories. Known. Little known.
Little known.
Well, I mean, they are.
I know you've heard quite a few. I mean, you got
yes.
Grandmaster Lung Ting.
Chen Chi Man.
Spewing stories.
Yeah. Also Buick Yip. Buick Yip told me a number of stories which are super interesting.
Buick Yip.
So Buick Yip was a student of Choi Sung Tin.
Yeah.
And Buick Yip makes everything Wing Chun, which is a company online where they sell like all the Wing Chun books and they sell dummies and stuff like that. So Buick Yip makes the dummies and the knives and I think the poles for everything Wing Chun, but really high. It's expensive stuff, but really high quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met Buick Yip a few years ago on a trip to Hong Kong. He speaks English quite well because I believe he did live in the States for some time.
Mm.
And so he's got a lot of old stories because he's one of these dudes who's like, he's been around for like a hot minute.
And I got to meet this guy.
Yeah. And so he told me kind of a funny story. Of course, I'm paraphrasing the story a little bit, so I don't want to butcher it. And if anyone remembers a better version of it, I'm open to being corrected on my recollection of it. But he told me that, you know, because in the movie The Grandmaster, the Tony Leung version of IP Man.
Yeah, with the hat.
He wears the hat, that fedora, right? And have you ever seen a photo of Yip Man wearing that hat? No.
Mm.
All right? As a matter of fact, Yip Man, there's only one photo of him wearing Western-style clothing. The suit one, which was like for an ID photo. Because he wasn't very fond of Western things. And as a matter of fact, Yip Man, what people don't realize, especially Westerners, because what we grew up on kung fu movies, like my first time I went to Hong Kong in 96, I was 18, and I expected everyone to be wearing like Chinese tong chong, like dressed the way you. I thought like seeing somebody wearing a jacket like that in Hong Kong would be totally normal, right?
Yeah.
And then what happens when I go to Hong Kong for the first time? Everyone's like wearing polo and brand name stuff and everyone's like ultra fashionable. And it's like, okay.
What's happening?
You know, where are all the like the dudes walking around in kung fu uniforms,
you must have
right?
felt like you went into a time vortex.
Something like that, right? I went to the future instead of the past. So, you know, I thought, you know, because you just confuse these things. Right? Mm. It's not like that at all, right? But you know, Yip Man died in 1972. 1972, you look at Hong Kong. Hong Kong's already a pretty modern city by that point. You know, in the 60s, you know, after the Second World War, it became one of the economic tigers of Asia. So, like, you know, Hong Kong had this huge renaissance especially through the 60s and 70s, where it just became this booming place of industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hong Kong, even by the 60s, was by no means you know, like a backwater city. It was quite modern, especially for Asia. And Yip Man, you know, most people at that time in the 60s, if you look at the photos from the 60s in Hong Kong, like you look at the group photos of all the old Sifus where they're sitting like all together, at, whether it's the Hong Kong Martial Art Association meetings, mm-hmm. all of the Sifus are wearing Western style suits. You know, they're there and they're wearing the Sai Chong, Sai West, the Western style suit, right? Wow. And look, Tang Sang had those white suits and, you know, they wore the Western style clothing. Yip Man was wearing the Chang Sam, the long style. And so he wore Chinese style clothing, not just when he was teaching or when he went to events, all the time. So he's on the street wearing Chinese style shoes and the long style jacket or a short one. All right.
He kept it real.
In the 60s. Yeah. And so even at that time, that wasn't normal, like, you know, for that many people to still be wearing that, right? So he really did not like Western-style clothing, right? So the funny thing is, why is he wearing this kind of almost, it's not, was it a fedora? What kind of, like, I don't know what type of hat that is, but the Tony Leung version, he's wearing that hat with the Chinese-style clothing, which is actually a pretty cool look. But there was a story where apparently he did have a hat like that, but it was short-lived. And so
I think I've heard this story.
Yeah, at that time, you know, although, you know, Hong Kong is still a relatively modern place, some pockets of Hong Kong less modern than others, right? So you actually had to go to, you know, to use the restroom. They didn't always have those facilities in the building. You might have to go to like a restroom facility outside, like not an outhouse, but like a city version, like a public toilet type thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so the story was that Yip Man went to use the public toilet. And in the area where the public toilet was, there were a bunch of drug addicts. And so Yip Man goes to sit on the john. All right. Again, don't shoot the messenger. I'm literally telling you the story that I heard. And so he, you know, takes off his, you know, his Chang Sam, because it's very long style clothing. So he hangs it. Maybe there's a hook there or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so he's sitting on the john and he's wearing his hat. And while he's using the bathroom, some drug addict, you know, opens the door, most likely to just kind of steal something or whatever, and sees Yip Man sitting on the pot there. And Yip Man is probably, you know, most likely kind of like, what the hell's going on? And he just takes Yip Man's hat, puts it on, and closes the door and leaves. And I just thought, wow, that's probably a lesser known Yip Man story,
that is
right?
So great.
Yeah. So anyway, that's so a lesser known story. I'm sure you haven't heard that before.
Oh no. The famous hat.
Right. So Ooh. It only existed for a short time. Why did he not have it? Some drug addict took it from him.
He probably went in. The drug addict probably went in to use the bathroom and saw that Yip Man was there, like, oh shit. He forgot to.
Yeah. Lock so in the 1960s, there's some like opium addict dude walking on the street with this slick hat.
Woo. You're not talking about Yip Man, opium addict.
Hey. Take it easy.
Oh, my bad. All right. Next up, we got Joe B. Are there any Wing Chun videos or books you would recommend to supplement training and is having a wooden dummy necessary? Thanks.
Oh, that's a great question. We've got a couple of similar questions lately, like people asking about book recommendations and things like that. Maybe we'll do an episode on like the best books and things like that. And, you know, that might be less snoozy than a Bed Judkins episode. Okay. So shameless plug. All right. I've written a number of books.
Yo.
And as a matter of fact, we are now in the final proofing stages of my wooden dummy book. Well, here's the thing, all right? Obviously, look, I have a podcast. I would love for people to buy my books, right? Support me, right? Don't support Amazon, support me. But I've tried to write books that I feel like, for example, I wrote a book on the Siunam Tao form, Cham Q. We're now in the proofing stage for the wooden dummy book. I will write BUG and I'm going to write Wing Chun 101. And I also have a movement book. I wrote these books in a way that I'm like, okay, I want to write books that are helpful to the people who need to learn these things, not books that just show how much I know or books that are going to say this version is better than that version, because you get so much of that in the Wing Chun books. You don't really get them teaching Wing Chun. You get these books selling their system, okay? And so I feel that, well, one, if you do a good job writing a book and helping people and being helpful, you are also simultaneously selling yourself as an instructor when people see that the quality of your instruction is very high. And you can give high-level instruction in a book without shitting on other Wing Chun people. And this is a lesson that a lot of other Wing Chun books don't really seem to understand, even if they're not direct about it. If you've been around for as long as I have, I can pick up a book written by Wing Chun Sifu X, and I can tell you, see this passage here? He's shitting on this Sifu who he has a conflict with. That the layman just sees, oh, you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. Yeah, I'm telling you, this he's writing here because he doesn't like that guy, and that is how this guy teaches it. Mm. So when I read it, all I just see are like, this is an attack on this guy, this is an attack on this guy, including the books from Leung Teng, to be fair. I'm not just saying books from other Wing Chun Sifus. To be fair, you pull out a Leung Teng book, and I can tell you, in the sections where he's going after other people, I can tell you exactly who he's going after, right? And I go, that is not the right way to use the platform of having a book. The right way is to be helpful. If I'm going to tell you I do the bong sao this way, which might be different from how the other person does it, I don't need to shit on that person's bong sao to explain to you how and why I do mine. I just need to explain to you in as clearly a way as I can why I do it the way I do it. And my appeal should be to logic, should be to principles, should be to concepts, not that this way is so much better because that guy sucks. Because I always found that that's a really strange way to say that what you do is good. The reason why, and it's kind of the silent implication in many Wing Chun books. The reason why, for example, my bong sao is the best is because everyone else's is shit.
Mm.
And what I hear from that is you are only better than what sucks. That doesn't mean you're good. It just means you're better than, you know, being better than what's shitty doesn't mean you're good. It just means you're better than what's shitty.
So if I write a book, I should stay away from the battle rap
idea. Exactly. Yeah. But or what you should do is this. You should thoroughly understand the alternate takes on, let's say, using bong sao as an example, all right? We use bong sao in a certain way in WT, but I should, as a Wing Chun instructor, understand what the other Wing Chun styles, how they present bong sao. So that instead of just using a straw man argument about, oh, they do it like this, look how stupid it is, you could totally get countered, I would give the best representation of another style's take on bong sao that is accurate and without political influence, and say other Wing Chun styles look at bong sao like this, and this is how they do it. And maybe perhaps even be able to demonstrate the other ways of using bong sao in a way that is accurate and faithful to the ways they actually do it. Because when most people show you how other styles do things, they clown it. Look at this. All right. And, you know, we can do that sometimes. But if I want to really compare methods, I don't want to compare what I do to a caricature of what someone else does. I want to compare what I do to the best of what someone else does. And then really put these two methods side by side and show that method might also work in that context. But our context is slightly different. That's why we look at it differently. So I've tried to write all of my books from that perspective. All right. Also because, you know, I'm a cog in the wheel of the Wing Chun system. I'm not a thought leader, and I certainly don't consider myself or use any of those weird titles that some of those other Wing Chun people use, right? So I don't have like a political stake to say this is my XYZ Wing Chun and you got to follow it like the Bible or something like that, right? So I would, you know, obviously recommend people to try out my books. I mean, look, if you're listening to this podcast and you like the words that are coming out of my mouth, then buy my books, because guess what? It's very similar vein, right? So you can go to citywt.com. I have my Siunam Tao book, The Little Idea, the Chumkyu book, Seek the Bridge, the movement book. If you have problems with, you know, some people cannot move their shoulders or their ankles or their, you know, they don't have the elbow mobility to, you know, bring their shoulder mobility to bring the elbows in. I literally wrote a book on how to be able to move well, so that you can perform Wing Chun at a high level, chock full of exercises, and also that's the martial arts movement for Wing Chun book, right? And then I have the 15 Chi Sao Fundamentals, which came out earlier this year for people who are starting double arm Chi Sao and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't just teach the program, also gives you background into Chi Sao. Why do we have Chi Sao? What is Chi Sao for? What is Chi Sao not for? Okay. Mm-hmm. And then now soon the Wooden Dummy book will be coming out soon on pre-order.
Which is being proofread by me. I mean, Michael Dean.
Yeah, Michael Dean. Actually someone who speaks English. but that book is the thickest book I've written. I mean, it's a very thorough, small tome on the Wooden Dummy. And I'm very excited about it because I took a lot of time researching it and putting it out there, right? So Having said that, all right, buy my book, citywt.com, tons of books, all right? Yeah. But there are obviously other books out there that are really fantastic. And I think David Peterson's books are really great. His books on Wangshan language, a collection of essays. I think that is one of the best books because you have essays about like historical stuff with Yip Man and with Wong Sun Leung and you know, background into the early development of Wing Chun in Hong Kong, which is fascinating. I could read about that stuff all day and never get bored. And then you have essays on like Wong Sun Leung's approach to like the various forms and stuff like that. So that, to be fair, to be honest, the book that David Peterson wrote, which is a collection of essays on, you know, from about his Sifu and about the Wong Sun Leung approach. I wish every lineage in Wing Chun had someone like David Peterson. Like, I'm waiting for, who is Choi Sung Tien's David Peterson? You know, and I'm not just saying because he's a foreigner, but like the foreigner has an advantage, especially someone like David Peterson who speaks and reads Chinese and can contextualize it for non-Chinese. And can take the Sifu's methods and demystify them and put them in a way where you can understand it, all right? I don't practice the Wong Sun Leung method of Wing Chun, but through David Peterson's writings and his videos and stuff, I have an appreciation for it and understand maybe kind of their mindset about certain things because he's able to articulate it so well. I want to have that same experience about Choi Sung Tien's Wing Chun. All right, and waiting for someone to kind of write that book for Choi Sung Tien stuff and someone for Leung Sung. Someone for, you know, Hao Kam Ming and stuff, right? Like all the different lineages that I really respect. Who is the person who's going to disseminate that lineage's teachings in a way that's crystal clear? I'm hoping to be that person for Leung Teng's methods, all right? And to be honest, my role model for writing my Wing Chun books is Sifu David Peterson. Because I go, wow. He's that guy for Wong Sun Leung who can really break it down in a way that makes a lot of sense, right? Like the and I'm not trying to ask people to compare it or whatever, right? But I think the biggest compliment for me would be to be looked at for Leung Ting's methods the same way that David Peterson is for Wong Sun Leung's methods, right?
Amazing.
Because he's really my role model in that. Not go, this is my spin on it. Like, let me contextualize Leung Teng's Wing Chun in a way that I don't feel that Sifu Leung Teng has done a good job in his own books, because his own books are full of political slights and not always being very clear about certain things. And certainly in my books, I talk about how I've updated some of the training methods, but I make it very clear. Look, these are things I updated because of XYZ. In the way I learned from Sifu Leung Teng, it's like this, and this is why, and this is the thought process, and these are the mottos, right? So, in that way, Sifu David Peterson is my role model for the books that I've written, because I always found everything that he wrote from the very early days, like articles I found that he wrote on the internet before I even had a chance to meet him, extremely helpful, not just in my understanding of the Wong Sun Leung lineage, but in Wing Chun in general. So I think it could be a compliment for any writer to kind of, you know, to strive to be more like Sifu David Peterson.
That is a great question, Joe B. Thank you. All right. Moving right along, we got Andrew Lin.
Andrew Lin, that name sounds Andrew familiar. Andrew Lin,
yeah, it does.
I think you're like the editor of this podcast.
I believe he is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or is Andrew Lin just the John Smith of, you know, Taiwan? There's so many Andrew Lins, you have no idea, right?
Might be a different Andrew Lin. You could might be right could about be. That. I thought I remembered you saying you do intermittent fasting. When you work out, do you usually do serious training in a fasted state?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Yeah, so about 2 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, I started to do intermittent fasting, which is, there are different ways of doing it. The split I did, basically, you eat in an 8-hour window, right? And then you fast for the remaining 16 hours a day.
Mm.
When I did that, that was actually the easiest way to lose weight. But the real secret to intermittent fasting is not, you have things like autophagy where your cells regenerate and stuff, but you have that whether you're fasting or not, right? And you also get a lot of that autophagy from doing strength training and things like that with the regeneration of cells. So it's not a factor that's unique to intermittent fasting. the reason why, obviously, you can lose weight is because it's caloric restriction. I mean, the fitness industry is always based on trying to sell you the newest, greatest thing because people try something and people give up, all right? And that doesn't mean the thing you gave up on doesn't work. It just means you gave up. So what do people look for? They look for something else. And there's always someone to tell you like, oh, no, calories in, calories out is not the thing. You need to eat keto or you need to eat this or you need to eat that or whatever. And if you really just want to lose weight, you need to – it's caloric restriction. You need to eat less. All right. You maintain weight. You got to keep that balance of calories based on what you're burning in the day. If you want to lose weight, you got to, you know, be burning more calories than you're taking in. And if you want to gain weight, you do the opposite, right? Pretty straightforward. I don't do intermittent fasting anymore, only because I figured out that the real secret of maintaining weight was just watching how much I ate. And it's no knock on intermittent fasting because actually I felt fine during intermittent fasting. I did it in a window where it kind of matched my training schedule, and then I would just not fast. Yeah, I would just fast for the rest of the day after that 8-hour window, and it worked really well. And it's a super what's good is look, there are many different ways to maintain weight and to lose weight or gain muscle, whatever it is you want to do. All right, and one way works for some person, the other way works for someone else. And the one person says, no, your way is wrong, even though those two different methods work for that person, right?
All right.
What's great about intermittent fasting is it's the easiest way you can just add rules to how and when you eat without having to think a lot about it. If you eat only in an 8-hour window, then you know when that 8-hour window is done, you're not going to eat for 16 hours. So that's already often going to restrict how many calories you take in. And then what you're going to do is you're going to feel, okay, well, if I feel a little groggy by some part in my fast, then you're probably going to eat up until the end of that 8-hour period. So you're going to kind of adjust it in a way that works for you, all right? So that worked great for me. I was doing that while I got into the strength training, you know, through the pandemic and everything, and it worked great. And then I realized, like, I can achieve the same results just eating the same amount of food, but I don't have to eat it just in this 8-hour window. And that was a little easier for me because it allowed me to spread my protein intake throughout the day rather than having to have it all through this 8-hour window. Especially if you're lifting weights a lot, you might want to have a little bit more protein spread out throughout the day. You don't want a big protein dump in the middle of the day and then none for the rest of the day. It's better to kind of parse that out as your body kind of goes through synthesizing that. So it's better to have that spread out a little bit. But my parents intermittent fast, and it's a great method for them. So, like, I did it, and I thought it was great, and I don't do it anymore. It's literally not a knock on
it.
Did you
introduce it to them?
No, they actually kind of found that out on their own.
All right.
And so it works. So if someone wants to maintain weight or lose weight or whatever, intermittent fasting is a very easy way to do it. But is it absolutely necessary to lose weight? No. Watch how many calories you eat. Watch Coach Greg on YouTube. Any of his diet stuff are there. And that's basically what I follow, right? So that's one thing. All right. You can do it because it's an easy way to restrict calories, but you don't have to do it. So I just watch how much I eat. And also I weigh myself every single morning.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And because, you know, some people are like, oh, you shouldn't do that because you're going to get stressed about how much weight. No. All right. You weigh yourself every single morning. You don't weigh yourself every 4 weeks when God knows what has happened in those 4 weeks. Did your weight go up and down? Did it just go up? Did it go down and then go up? Did it just go down? If you go every day, all right, and you see, okay, I gained a pound. Pound's not a big deal. That could be water weight. I gained 2 pounds, all right, from there, okay? Could still be water weight. But now you're like 3, 4, 5, 6 pounds, you're going up. You know something's wrong. So you change something right away. Would you rather find out in 3 days that your weight is slightly going up, or in 4 weeks your weight really went up and now all of a sudden you have a problem there, right? So just literally get a scale, weigh yourself every morning and write it down. Or if you have their apps now that can track that, you weigh it, it goes to the app, it's in there, right? You can see your weight there. So you weigh yourself every day and you know immediately what's working and what's not. Now your weight shouldn't be going up and down crazy every day, but you're gonna start to see certain trends there. If I ate a little too much or didn't have enough or whatever, and this is how you calibrate. Well, I lost weight and I wasn't trying to lose weight. That meant I did not eat enough. You need to know that. For my current level of exercise, I don't wanna lose weight. I lost weight, I didn't eat enough. You also wanna know that, right? So there are a lot of ways to figure out without intermittent fasting, the lessons of intermittent fasting. If you just track a little bit, all right? So, but if people like intermittent fasting, 100%. The thing is, the other part is about exercising while fasted. I don't recommend it, Okay. Now, having said that, I exercise all the time while I'm fasted just because of my schedule. It works out, but I don't do it that often. Normally, I have my breakfast in the morning and I'm going to wait at least an hour before I actually go and work out, because you don't want to work out with a bunch of food in your stomach, right? Give yourself at least an hour or more. But a lot of people think, oh, if you exercise in a fasted state because you don't have stores of food in your system, that means you're automatically going to be taking your energy from fat. So you're going to burn more fat. That is the theory, right? So if I do, let's say, my morning cardio fasted, then I'm not burning all the sugar from that cereal that I ate. I'm getting that exercise or getting that energy from fat. And that doesn't seem to be the case. All right. Okay. So that is kind of bro science, like the anabolic window after you work out. This is kind of a lot of stuff that like your CrossFitter bro accepts is actually been debunked for many years. But this stuff just gets perpetuated. All right. Mm-hmm. And you can see, look, I have a heart rate monitor because I'm a stats junkie. I want to know what my heart rate is doing. I want to know how many watts was I pulling on the rower. I want to know how hard did I go in that 30-minute bike session. I want to know how many punches. I have those things that go in the wrist wraps that count how punches. Many punches you do. Okay. How many punches did I do in these 3 minutes versus that 3 minutes? Because I like to see what methods in my training are producing results and what things are making me more tired. So I'm a stats junkie, right? And so I did the fasted cardio thing for a while, but not, I just wanted to test it out. And your performance when you're fasted is always subpar compared to when you have energy because you ate on a normal schedule. It's always subpar. And there are studies that will show this, all right? You say that people lose their freaking minds. Yo, my fasted cardio, it's only burning fat. Dude, if you like to do fasted cardio, do fasted cardio.
Yeah, just to
the fact that the Kung Fu genius thinks it's bullshit doesn't mean it's bullshit for you. Just do it. Be happy. Like, people hear someone say something that goes against what they do and they lose their minds about that. Hey, man, do you like what you're doing? Yes. Is it working for you? Yes. Then freaking do it and don't listen to what anyone else says. Are you not sure about something? Are you on the fence and you want more information? Okay, now maybe listen to someone who has experience with it. But if you're doing it and it works for you, don't get bent out of shape because someone else doesn't like it. This is like literally the all of YouTube comments, right? Mm-hmm. You don't believe exactly like I believe, even though you're a different person who grew up somewhere else. I just cannot accept this. Calm down, buddy. I track the stats on my performance from fasted cardio to non-fasted cardio, and it just goes so much harder. You can go so much harder and longer when you're not fasted, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes fasted cardio, I have to do it in the morning because I don't have time to do my cardio in that day. And after I eat breakfast, I need to go and shoot to the school and I need at least an hour after breakfast before I do cardio. So on that day, I have to do the cardio before I eat because it's a timing thing. It's literally the convenience of when I do it. So I know that my cardio session is not going to be harder than last time, to quote Coach Greg. So I'm going to have to do it fasted just because of a convenience thing, because I don't have time to wait. But you know, the one benefit I feel of fasted cardio, you feel like shit because you don't have any energy. So it's a mental slog. And so I feel that, like, for training yourself to kind of push when you don't have any energy and you feel like crap, which is like every time you're ever going to need to defend yourself.
Yeah.
It's got a good mental component. And so sometimes I'll go like, all right, here's me at my worst and I got to do 30 minutes on the bike. And then after that, I eat my breakfast and then I can go. Right. But although I would prefer not to do it that way. So there are benefits to it. It's contextual and you got to find what works for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right down to the bare facts. All right. Willy Wonka.
Wow.
We got in the full available version of the Game of Death footage. Bruce, after defeating Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, walks back down the stairs without going up the next level and retrieving the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why. I have watched John Little's A Warrior's Journey, but wondering if more information has come to light since. I think this is a two-parter.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because we saw Alan Canvin, who took all of that footage, all the footage that does exist, most of it, which was shown in the John Little documentary, The Warrior's Journey, and he kind of cut it in a way that seems congruent to what Bruce's idea was, and which included, because of course the thing was shot without sound, so they had to kind of add the sound later.
Right.
And there were a couple gems in there because he came and he showed it to us. Matt Pauly was there. I think that's when you met Matt Pauly. And then we watched it and they talked a little bit about it, including that one line that they didn't know what it was. And then he got the lip reader to find it out or whatever. So Alan Canvin did a really good job putting that together.
Amazing
and,
job.
And talking about, you know, some of the ideas in Bruce's script.
Is it available yet for
I don't know. I don't know where you would have the ability to see it because I think there's copyright issues, which is why I think it needs to be shown privately. I don't think he can just show it openly, although I don't know with YouTube fair use and stuff like that. I'm not sure how that stuff plays out. No, I don't know because obviously I believe in the original idea. And remember, Bruce essentially had a treatment for Game of Death. He didn't have a full bore script, okay? Fight me on that. Show me the script. Where's the script? All right. He had maybe more than a treatment, but not quite a script. And so I believe it's like his sister is kidnapped and he's got to go and get her or whatever. So why then, after beating Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, does he not then go up?
To get his sister?
To get his sister? I don't know. All right. That may be a question for someone more knowledgeable than me.
Maybe
he
wasn't that close with his sister. Maybe he just didn't like her.
So
that
he goes
much.
All the way there, beats up everyone, and he's about to go rescue. And then goes, nah.
He likes
and then
fighting
goes down.
More.
He just likes fighting. Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. He just wanted to see what he could do. He wanted to play the first live video game.
Of course.
Going up until he fights the final boss. Yeah, I don't know. That's a question for someone who's a little bit more knowledgeable on those things.
Could have had some kind of family grudge.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's possible.
Yeah.
You have a sister, doesn't want to talk to you or something, and you're just like, I really need help. You get out there and like, see, this is what you get, love. And then you just walk away.
That's right. Remember when you didn't share
your
toys with
this
me
on
when
yourself.
I was younger?
Yeah.
All right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you brought this on yourself, sis.
How dare you disrespect me at dinner?
Yep.
Next question, two-parter, from Willy Wonka.
All right. Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for KFG fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to WCINewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner. Fill out your email and password and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to all the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this cool guy on the cover. That's me for those of you listening to us on audio. My Kung Fu Genius column is also in all the new issues, as if you needed another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And now back to me.
I wonder, did Bruce fear of being pigeonholed just as a martial arts actor and wanted to branch out in other roles?
That's a good question. I mean, I've been dealing with so much Bruce Lee stuff lately since the drug letters. I have to really go back and reread a lot of the Carriage stuff about the stuff that he wrote about during that time to really get a better answer on that without just pontificating out of my ass. Bruce had definitely mentioned to Sekin, Han from Enter the Dragon, that he really wanted to get into directing. Okay. Most likely martial art movies. I mean, hey, look, Bruce was at the beginning of his film career taking off. So, you know, there is the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it, right? So Bruce Lee, obviously known as a martial artist and as a martial arts actor, most likely would have stayed with martial arts for a little bit. I mean, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense that his next movie would be a love story, you know, it doesn't make sense that it would go into that.
He kind of did that back in the day. He did roles like that, non-martial art roles.
Yeah, but that's when he was a kid actor. Right. And so, first of all, he's
probably want to get away from that.
No, I mean, he was a kid actor. He was just doing jobs, you know, and his father was well-connected, and he was doing that stuff because that was almost like the family business, right? Mm-hmm. But also, he was not known as a martial artist at that time. So it's not like he was a martial artist and then was just doing non-martial art roles. Because remember, he really did not learn Wing Chun for that long. He learned Wing Chun just for a short time before he was 18. No, he was learning Wing Chun since he was 13. No, he wasn't. Look at the timeline. He wasn't. He started after he went to St. Francis Xavier, not when he was in LaSalle. He didn't start Wing Chun when he was 13.
Yeah.
Show me the timeline. Okay. Yeah, I know we said it, all right? But if you ask me, when did I first start doing XYZ when I was a teenager? I don't know, when I was 12.
When did you start skateboarding?
I see. I couldn't tell you that. I could. I would tell you maybe when I was 12, but maybe the real answer is 9. I don't know.
Right.
So we're not even always the most accurate narrators of our own story, because it's not like you were writing everything down and going, when I was 12, I said, because when you start something, you just do it. This thing catches your interest and you start doing it and you don't go, I am 12 years old right now.
When did you do your first Ollie?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. When I was 11? No, dude, it was when you were... Yo, man, I was there when he did his first... He did it when he was 10 years old. Dude, he was 13 when he did his first Ollie, all right?
Okay.
I mean, like, seriously, all right? People, like, timeline, you got to look at it. It's really after he went to St. Francis Xavier. So he cannot be younger than 15 when he started Wing Chun. So a lot of the roles he played as a child actor were actually before he started learning Wing Chun. All right? So we have the orphan... All right, where I talked about his hand already being chewed up from doing that stuff there. But he was still not known as a martial artist at that time, right? So it's a bit of an apples and oranges comparison. For sure, if Bruce's star would have kept rising, you do what everyone else does. I mean, here, Arnold Schwarzenegger at some point made Kindergarten Cop.
Yeah.
All right? You know, how many commandos and stuff like that are you going to do, right? So I think it's an, you know, Jim Carrey, famous comedian.
Not a tumor.
You know, at some point, Jim Carrey goes from comedy to doing, like, serious stuff or whatever. So I think that, you know, same thing with Tom Hanks. I think it's, some people don't realize that Tom Hanks was, like, a comedic actor way back in the day.
Right.
You know, and then suddenly it's like...
Bosom Buddies.
Yeah, you think of him as, like, this serious actor, right? Philadelphia and Forrest Gump and all those other... And then all the movies after that, right? And Castaway and stuff. And it's like, you know, and I'm thinking like The Man with One Red Shoe.
The Burbs.
All right. The Burbs. The Burbs, yo, big, the Burbs, all that stuff,
yes.
Right?
Boom.
So I think it's a normal evolution of most actors who are successful to at some point change hats a little bit. I don't think that that was going to happen with Bruce anytime soon. I don't know if people were really clamoring to see Bruce and Raquel Welch in a movie together. Like, I don't know. All right.
Bruce Lee's Othello.
Yes, exactly.
Wow.
but I do know that at the time of Bruce Lee's death, there were talks about him doing an action movie with like Charles Bronson. And
that would have been
dope.
Lit.
That would have been absolutely dope.
What?
Right? So you know, but who knows? What? I mean, you know, the what ifs about Bruce Lee's career and life had he not passed away. Makes one a little sad. Like if you're a Bruce Lee fan, you really want to know, maybe it would have peaked with Enter the Dragon, but maybe he would have done some other stuff that was really great. Part of me wants to see, I have an unpopular opinion about Game of Death, and it's that if Bruce had finished it, it would have been a train wreck because it was a narrative mess. Part of me wants to see the completed Bruce Lee Game of Death with Bruce Lee in it because I think it kind of would have been, save for the fight scenes, I think it would have been a bit of a train wreck. Oh, so anyway.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Next up, we got Richard White.
Okay.
Dear KFG, if your daughters wanted to learn Wing Chun in the future, would you teach them or would you hand them over to one of your instructors and why? Much love, guys.
Uh-huh.
Keep up the hypothetical, alleged good work.
Uh-huh. Alleged good work, yeah. Well, my daughters are learning some martial arts, and they're learning from you.
Oh.
So
this Nifka.
I do, I do some TFG. Stuff playful with them. My daughters don't really seem to have a whole lot of interest in martial arts. They kind of do it, you know, for fun. They come on Saturdays and do some martial arts training, and it's good for them to learn some, you know, basic self-defense and things like that.
Really good with the stay away bad guys.
Yeah, of course, if they really want to do it and they get serious about it, you know, of course I will teach them. I think part of the problem with kids. Of, you know, people who teach martial arts is there's always that expectation like, oh, your father or your mother is a famous martial artist, so you have to be able to do this. Like, look at Brandon Lee. You know, after Bruce passed away, Brandon had a big chip on his shoulder for a very long time. It took him a little while before he finally embraced his father, and he had to get a little older to realize that because can you imagine? People say dumb, unthinking shit all the time, thinking that they're being funny and polite and stuff like that. Can you imagine Brandon at 10 years old, his father had been, you know, had passed away for a couple of years, going like, oh, you're Bruce Lee's son. Oh, better watch out around you. Can you imagine how many times he probably heard something like that? Damn. Like, oh, do you also do? Can you imagine that? And can you imagine how angry that must have made like Brandon at 10, 11 years old, because you are born into something you can't control. All right. Your father is this like larger than life, legendary icon, and you're the son. And everyone is looking at you. And they try to make these kind of funny jokes like, oh, you're Bruce Lee's son, I should watch out around you. Can you imagine the 100th time you've heard an adult say that to you as a kid? You want to just kick this dude in the nuts. All right? And so you can imagine that is a seriously unfair burden to put on anyone. And I think the problem is that sometimes parents, who themselves are accomplished in a field, whether it's dance or martial arts or whatever, and they want their kids to do that, all right? Sometimes they
want to pass the torch.
Yeah, well, sometimes their kids are really into it because, yeah, martial arts is a cool thing. And some kids are into martial arts and your dad or your mom is a famous martial artist, so there you go. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it works out and you see that and people go like, oh, isn't that amazing, right?
People assume it's in the genes.
Yeah, but other times, so like my daughters don't really have that because by the time I was Maria's age, I was already like, I had already been doing martial arts really seriously for almost 2 years. And so I would watch if there was a martial arts fight on TV, I would be like looking at it or whatever. Like she sees all sorts of cool action in the Marvel movies and other movies or whatever. It's not like she doesn't get totally blown away by that stuff. So I see that she doesn't necessarily have that martial arts spark. Mm-hmm. All right. But that's totally okay.
Yeah.
Because I think just like teachers often impose their burdens on their own students, I think parents impose their own burdens on their kids.
Mm.
You have to, you know, I'm going to live vicariously through my kids and do it in a way that I could never do it or whatever. And that's such an unfair burden because I always think of Brandon Lee after his father passed away. And it doesn't matter if your parent is alive or not. You still have that burden. You can have that burden both ways. They passed away. They're legendary. You have that burden. Oh, you're the son of so-and-so. Mm. Or you're the daughter of so-and-so. Or that person is alive and they're like, you got to do martial arts because you are my son or daughter. And so I have a school in Midtown Manhattan. People come to me voluntarily and pay me money to teach them martial arts. And they come back and they do it for years and years and years. And they love it. And they take extra lessons and they buy my books at citywt.com and they're super, super into it. And they came to me because they wanted it. Mm-hmm. And these are people who are coming to me. They seek it out. And I have a school full of those people and, you know, people who come to like my immersion course in Florida or train with me online or whatever. There's no shortage of people going out of their way to seek what I have to offer. All right. Why the hell would I force someone to learn from me?
Mm.
And so I think sometimes the parents who force their kids to do the thing that they do, maybe they don't teach it professionally, so they don't have the option of, well, you got people who are voluntarily coming to you. Why would you? The worst thing I could do is force someone. I would never. Sometimes it's rare because we teach adults. So most adults who come to City Wing Chun, they come here because they want to do it. Every once in a while, it's very rare because we don't really teach kids. You have an adult here where you feel like they're here and they don't really want to be here. Wow. All right. I mean, it's very rare. You know that because most we teach adults. So adults come, they want to do it. They join, they sign up and they're into it and they either stay or they leave at some point. Right. Whatever. But sometimes people join maybe because they think they would like it and they don't really like it. And occasionally you get an adult who's here, but they're not really into it. And for me, that's always like pulling teeth because I literally don't care if someone is physically gifted or super talented in Wing Chun or the person is totally uncoordinated and has two left feet. If someone comes in and they love it and they try, mm-hmm. I'll teach both of these people the same way. Not just the talented one, give them everything, and the untalented one. I hold the untalented one up to a high level of excellence as well. Like, okay, yeah, you're making a mistake. I'm going to be on you to not make those mistakes, but I'm still going to teach you with the same, you know, desire and drive that I teach the person who gets it the first time. I'm not going to give up on you just because you're uncoordinated or it takes you longer to learn something. Okay. All right. The only thing I need to see is you come in and you put effort. You put effort, I give you everything. Sometimes we have visitors, they didn't grow up in this school. They grew up in another school and maybe the vibe is different. And they come in and they kind of act like they just want to take. And they don't put the effort forward. I'm less motivated to teach that student, regardless of how talented they are. All I want to see is you come and you give effort and you try your best and you try to improve every single time, I'll give you my heart, Okay? But if someone is kind of, it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so for me, forcing someone to learn something that they don't want to do is putting myself in that situation on purpose. So my daughters, they're into dance. They're into all sorts of, and whatever they want to do, you want to go learn dance? Let's go to dance.
Yeah.
All right. You want to learn to play this sport? Let's go and play that sport. You want to do gymnastics? Do this or whatever. Last thing I would ever want to do is impose my burden on my daughters, because if they want to come and learn it from me, I'm always here. All right, or they can learn from you or anything like that, right? But if they're not really into it and I make them do it, then I'm going to make them hate it. I would rather maybe they don't want to do it now. But as they get a little older, maybe they get a little of appreciation for what their old man has done. And then they want to do it. Pretty and cool. You know what? At that point, it comes from their heart and they really want to do it. And then I'll really give them everything. Or I can force them to do it now in a way that's not fun for them. And I kill a chance of them ever coming back to want to do it because I made it something they hate. Mm. And I think parents need to think a little harder about forcing that stuff on their kids.
Man. That's deep.
It's true, though.
All right.
There we go.
Next up, we got Dryzen.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. That just slipped out. I apologize.
What's the problem with Dryzen?
If the preamble to this question goes more than 3 minutes, I'm going to punch you in the face.
I'm actually going to put a timer on it.
Okay, go ahead and put a timer on it.
What? 3 minutes.
All right.
Dude, actually, it's all...
Can you
encap... It's not even written.
It's not even written. He just admitted it's not even written.
Wow. There's not that much written in the question. That's what I'm about to say.
Got it.
All right, okay.
Let's do it. Much written. All right, you got the timer on? 3 minutes. Let's go.
All right. All right, so you're upstairs on your hypothetical. That's what
hypothetical. Got it.
So you're upstairs hitting the bag. You go into a really crazy training session with the bag, heavy bag, and you pass out.
Okay.
Just fall out, pass out. No one's around.
Mm-hmm. That's more than likely going to happen on the rower instead of the heavy bag. I've almost passed out on that thing a few times.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very much like you, but I'm
I know.
No, but he trains crazy sometimes.
Yeah, but
I've seen him.
Yes, I know. But
I've seen it.
But Dryzen hasn't.
Oh, you're right. You're right about that. Dryzen doesn't know.
How would he know, Dry?
I know. How would he?
Yeah.
But anyway,
you give someone enough rope. They'll hang themselves.
You pass out and you wake up. You come to.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote. You come to.
Uh-huh. He wrote.
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote.
How are we doing on those 3 minutes, by the way?
Oh, I don't want to give him any ideas.
Mm. You come to and you're in this strange-ass setting.
Mm-hmm.
Living room.
A living room.
Naked.
What?
What? What?
Yeah.
That's weird.
And the living room has barely anything on the walls. It's just bare.
Okay.
You got a chair in the middle.
Uh-huh.
Not in the middle, but in the corner.
Okay.
And you're naked. What the fuck?
Right.
Where am I?
Jesus Christ.
Okay, wait. Dryzen is imagining the KFG naked.
No. This is what he wrote. I don't know what he's imagining. I don't know his imagination.
You're
trying to twist it up.
Hey, before we say anything, it was really cold that day.
All right,
let's go.
Anyway,
he was in the pool.
You get up, you're just looking around like, whoa. You sit down in a chair in the corner, and a screen pops up on the wall.
I sit down in the chair, but I'm not wearing anything.
You know what? As soon as you sit down, a screen.
Okay.
On the wall, like a weird projector.
Okay.
And it goes into the news, and you find out that you're in, like, the year 3021.
Okay.
And you're like, whoa. What the? And all of a sudden, you're just like, you look on the chair, and it's little control.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, whoa. And then you look up. Wing Chun. No Wing Chun. You can't find any Wing Chun anywhere on the planet that you're on.
There will definitely be no Wing Chun in 1,000 years.
What do you do?
What do I do?
Yeah.
I'd be freaking out because it's 1,000 years from now and I'm naked in a living room.
3 minutes?
There we go. 3 minutes. Perfect. All right.
What do you do?
Dre.
Dreyson, yeah. He wrote
the
that here.
The existential terror of waking up in a living room that's like white with nothing on the walls and a chair there. 1,000 years in the future. Where's my family? What am I doing here? Why am I not wearing anything? Do you think I give a shit about Wing Chun? Are you kidding me?
So you don't care that Wing Chun doesn't exist anymore?
Where the hell is my family? Why am I naked? Where am I?
Why are you naked, by the way?
Yeah, you're going to go out in 1,000 years. People are gonna look different in 1,000 years, right? Think about the slow evolutionary changes that are going to happen, the melding of all the different cultures. You're going to go out and you're going to look at people. People are going to actually look different in 1,000 years.
Think so?
I don't mean like they're going to have extra eyes and stuff, but I mean just like the predominant facial characteristics, skin tones, things. Everything's going to be different, right? What kind of vehicles are out there? Do they even have vehicles? Is the earth torched? What is the air not breathable? Where the hell is my family? Where's my wife? Where's my kids? Why am I here?
Yeah.
All right. I guarantee you, Wing Chun is the, where the hell is my underwear? All right. I guarantee you, Wing Chun is going to be the least of my worries at that point.
Nah.
That's crazy.
I don't believe that. If you step outside, you might need it.
Yeah, Wing I'm not Chun, worried about that. I got the Wing Chun.
You got the Wing Chun.
All right.
Do you bring it to the future? 3021.
No, it's not going to make it that long. You're going to see, there's going to be a museum of martial arts, and you're going to go into a traditional martial arts room, and you're going to hit a button, and it's going to have all these things like, oh, this was a style called Wing Chun. This is later morphed, and elements of this are in the modern mixed martial arts, but, you know, this stuff you're going to see in a museum.
Wow. Right?
We're the last of the dinosaurs, man.
So you're not going to bring it back? 3021?
I'm going to try to find a way to go back in time and go back home and see my kids. Are you kidding? This is terror. This is pure terror. All right?
And then you look up the Richter clan.
No, I want to go
and
back.
You see, you got your great grandkids right there next door.
I think there are a few more greats. I think you underestimated the greats.
Yeah, right.
That would be interesting to see, but you know, and obviously, you know, nowadays with everything being digital, they certainly would have records of from at least me all the way until that point, mm-hmm. provided the earth doesn't implode from people hating each other. No, man, that's terrible.
You meet them though. You meet them and you find out they're doing Wing Chun.
Yeah, and I'm like, hey, can I borrow some clothes? All right, next question.
All right. Thank you, Dreyson, for that question. That was really cool.
Was it, though? Was it, Dreyson?
Was it?
I'm sorry?
Let's go.
All right. Next up, we got Miguel C.
Miguel C. It's been a while since we had a question from Miguel C.
All right. He's back up in the mix.
That's what's up.
He's sort of like Dreyson, who doesn't get in enough.
No, he's not at all like Dreyson. He's an actual person.
Oh, Dreyson's an actual person.
Yes, Dreyson is an actual person. He's just not who he says it is.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that Miguel C. is, in fact, Miguel C.
Miguel C. Mm-hmm. All right. Miguel C.
From Chelsea.
C for Alex.
Yo.
I understand that you also train BJJ. My question is, have you added any of it to your Wing Chun or plan to in the future like another NYC Sifu did? I won't mention his name. Thank you. I wonder who he's talking about.
I know who he's talking about. I don't know why he doesn't mention his name. He's talking about Chung Kwok Chow, who trained a little bit, I think, with Henzo back in the day, and then he called it Integrated Wing Chun, and he kind of put those elements together. I don't know why is that a big secret? Everyone knows that
a big secret? I don't even know who this dude is. But
No, the Chung Kwok Chow, Sifu Chung Kwok Chow, is one of the OGs of the New York Wing Chun scene. And you know, at some point, I think in the 90s or early 2000s, he started to mix some of those things. And I mean, that's fine. I mean, people can do whatever the hell they want. I don't know why that's a big secret. Everyone knows that. You can literally Google it. Why is that a big deal?
Right.
No, I mean, I dabble in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm not like anything special in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but you've been dabbling it with some of the higher tiered guys out there who are doing it. And so I use it to improve how we approach certain aspects of self-defense and also how we approach, you know, dealing with someone trying to take you down, like learn actually how these guys are going to take you down so we can improve how we apply our Wing Chun against it rather than necessarily putting those elements in. Who knows what the future holds, maybe a little more of an integrated approach. But as for now, it's more just about rounding out the program and the offerings and making sure that what we teach in terms of how we use Wing Chun is well-rounded and is done with looking at what other people are doing in mind rather than just kind of wholesale going like Pak Sao chain punch flying armbar. All right. Like, maybe that's not the best thing to put together, but having some basic ground fighting and escape strategies and avoiding certain kinds of holds and locks and stuff like that, I think is necessary for all traditional martial artists to practice now.
Mm-hmm. What's up? That's dope. All right. Next up, we got Paul Popelboon.
Mm-hmm.
Is the photograph of him curling the long barbell weight in one single arm 115 pounds or 135 pounds? And where was the photo taken? The office of Black Belt Magazine?
Mm.
I'm assuming he's talking about Bruce. A photo or of Bruce curling? Yip Man.
Yeah, no. There's no photo of Yip Man curling weights. No. All
right. There isn't?
No.
So all right. Pictures of Yip Man just, curling.
Yes, yeah, curling. He was on the Hong Kong curling team. All right. Curling is ridiculous. Curling just looks like something that people who are drunk on ice look, if I use the broom, the thing's gonna kind of move in this direction. It's not even really a sport. It looks like something my kids would make up if you gave them enough time.
Yeah.
If you start watching it at 3 o'clock in the morning after smoking enough weed, you get very, very into it.
Got it.
Secondly, all right. You always feel like those guys just basically were like out drinking and then happened to just stumble onto an Olympic ice rink, and then the next thing you know, they're like winning.
I'm non-controversial statement. Mm-hmm. Curling is bullshit. Okay, so there's a photo of Bruce Lee. He's curling on a barbell. I don't remember if it was one arm or two arm, but it's kind of an iconic photo of him doing it. But again, because you just asked me the questions here, we're going off of his description of the photo. So it's different, like if I had a link of the photo and I can go, oh, this one here. Because now we're going to my photographic memory of Bruce Lee photos that I've seen in my life, right? So I know in my mind, I'm thinking like there's one where he's dressed in very 70s swanky. I think he's in bell bottoms. I think he even has his high-heeled boots.
What?
And he's curling a barbell with some weight on it. I don't remember if it's one arm or two arm or whatever, but I'm pretty sure that was at Golden Harvest Studios. That wasn't at... So, in general, okay?
Golden Harvest, not Gold's Gym.
Yeah, not Gold's Gym. In general, when people want to timeline photos, for the most part, if Bruce has a haircut that looks like it's from one of his movies, it's Hong Kong. All right, unless it's when he was in Thailand shooting Big Boss.
Oh, that's what's up.
Right, because when you look at that, people are like, was that at Black Belt Magazine? No, he's like got Enter the Dragon hair. And he's most likely was not at Black Belt office. Although he did go to L.A. a couple times in January where he bought those pants. Yeah. And then he did actually go back to L.A. in between his May 10th collapse and his death on July 20th. He actually went to L.A. real quick. He went to the doctors to get checked out at UCLA. And also there was some final business about Enter the Dragon. So he had his May 10th collapse and then he goes to LA and then he comes back to Hong Kong and dies. And all this happens in the span of like a couple months, right? So yeah. It's possible that in that short trip, when he's recovering after that collapse that he did that barbell pose. But I'm pretty sure if it's the one where he's wearing the high-heeled boots, I think that was at Golden Harvest.
Okay.
Studios, Hammer Hill Roads in Kowloon. Yeah. By the way, remember a couple episodes ago, I think it was Dryson had a question about what if I end up in Betty Ting Pei's apartment when Bruce is collapsing?
Yeah.
And like, what do I do? Do I save Bruce or do I let him die? And in that episode, I'm like, look, Baptist Hospital is like 5 minutes
right
from there, right? I know where Betty Ting Pei's apartment is. It's like 67 Beacon Hill Road, 60-something. It's kind of at the end there of Beacon Hill Road.
How do you know where Betty Ting Pei's apartment is?
It's public information, man.
Oh, public.
Okay. If you're... All right. Are you kidding me? First of all, I doubt very highly she still lives there anyway, right? So,
We can ask your boy.
We know a few people who know Betty. We can ask them. I don't think she's living in the same place, but maybe she is, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's
never mind.
I think that I said, oh, it's just like a 5-minute walk, right?
Why are you wilding?
So I think I said it was just like a 5-minute walk from Betty's to Baptist Hospital, which was the closest one. But, you know, they ended up not taking him there.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up taking him all the way to Queens Elizabeth, which was across from where we stayed in Hong Kong at that time, which annoying. Is all the way down in so Yau Ma Tei, right? But of course, by the time they took him to the hospital, he was already dead anyway. Didn't really literally matter what hospital they took him to. He was DOA. But, you know, in that Dryzen hypothetical, it was like, what do I do? Do I save Bruce or do I let him die and let history kind of roll out the way it should
be?
I love
Dryzen hypothetical.
You do, right? And I'm like, I'm going to put him on his back and run him to the hospital because I could probably get him to the hospital faster than the ambulance could go there, right? And I'm like, it's like 5 minutes, all right? So anyway, yesterday I was on the train and I was kind of bored and I put in Betty Ting Pei's address in Google Maps and then I go, okay, is my recollection, because I literally, if you dropped me right now in front of Betty Ting Pei's apartment, without a map, without Google, I could take you right to Baptist Hospital. I know that neck of Hong Kong so well, right? So I'm like, okay, I could totally do it, right? So I'm like, all right, what does Google Maps say? So Google Maps said it's a 17-minute walk, okay? Now, of course, that's a walk, all right? If I had Bruce slung over my shoulder and he's like passed out.
Emergency situation.
I'm not walking.
No.
And he's a buck 20. Maybe he's a buck 18 at this point in his life. Yeah, he's, you know, I squat weights more than that right now, right? So I'd put him over my shoulder because he would be slumped. So he'd be dead weight, right?
Mm.
So I couldn't piggyback him because I don't know if he has enough strength to actually hold on to me, right? Mm. So I need to like kind of fireman's carry him over my shoulder, right? Which is going to be strenuous, right? I was actually thinking, because you know me, I'm such a nerd.
Would you make it?
All right. Wow. No, you know, I'm such a nerd when it comes to these things. Like, I'm a stats geek. I'm thinking I want to actually run an experiment because I want to actually go the same distance from Betty Ting Pei's place to Baptist Hospital.
Yeah.
Carrying 120-pound weight over my shoulder.
You want to do it.
Yeah, and I want to see if I can actually do it. Yeah, because I'm such a nerd, I'm going like, all right. You know, I'm doing the Dryzen hypothetical, I'm like, oh, it's 5 minutes away. Because it's in my mind, I'm like, it's just right there, right? So I looked it up, okay, it's a 17-minute walk, all right? Yeah. And I believe it's actually mostly downhill. And that's just walking. That's not talking about anyone going fast and doing whatever, right? And I would definitely, if I had Bruce there with me, I would be like, you know, I got to get him to the hospital really quick, right? I think I could do it in 9 to 11 minutes.
So next time we go to Hong Kong, we got to test it.
Oh, God. Can you imagine? People would be like, what the hell's going on? We should get one of those training dummies. We get Danny, right? The training dummy. But we got to load him up to make him 100 because he's only about 60 pounds right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to like double his weight.
Yeah.
And to just stick a big old kettlebell in his chest.
Oh, yes.
And then see. Okay, Can you take 120 pounds of dead weight over your shoulder from Betty Ting Pei's apartment to Baptist Hospital in a reasonable amount of time, provided that he has not already passed away? Mm. So I think I could do it, but I'm also talking out of my ass. So it's also possible, like, because it is also hills, it's mostly downhills, but there might be some parts where you go up. I don't think it would be easy, but it would be like a Bruce Lee challenge, right?
Wow, this is coming up.
You gotta find an actual human being to do it.
Yes, well... Yo, how much you weigh? You're like a buck 20, right?
155.
Oh, you're too fat. All right.
Too fat. I haven't been called fat ever.
Yes, yes. No, your body type is definitely not that, right? But yeah, no, so I need to get someone who's a buck 20.
Okay.
And we need to run this thing, right? The Bruce Lee hypothetical test. Man. Could you bring a passed out Bruce, a buck 20 person over your shoulder to Baptist Hospital in a reasonable amount of time?
That's lit.
Provided you would know all the details of his condition. You would run in, he's suffering from cerebral edema right now. His brain is swelling. He's passed out. You need to give him mannitol right away. You need to be ready to go, right? So it's literally just a matter of time. Saying like from the moment he started to feel woozy, let's say you had 30 minutes that you had to get him treated by then, right? Like, could you get him into the hospital in time? Because first of all, you would have to get him set up. You'd have to either go down the elevator or down the stairs. Although, actually, I think Betty was on the first floor.
You want to carry him naked?
oh no, you just got to put a blanket on him. You don't have time to get him dressed. You got to get him to the hospital right away.
You don't have penis on your back.
You don't take it easy. Take it easy. All right. You wrap him in a blanket. All right. Okay. Take it easy, and then you throw him over there. Right. All right. Give him a little bit of dignity. Right.
This is your theme today.
Yeah. This is the theme. Right.
What?
Yeah.
Not my theme.
Hey, but tell you what, if there were no clothes and no blanket, I would run a naked Bruce Lee. It's Bruce Lee. You got to bring, dude. First of all, anybody, you want to save someone's life, who cares? Yeah. All right. And by the time you're running, if cops see you carrying some naked dude on your shoulder, then maybe they're going to pick you up and bring him there even quicker. All right. Okay. So this is fine. It's all the attention you need to get him there quicker. All right. So I'm very curious. So next time I'm in Hong Kong, I want to try. You know, carrying a 120-pound person.
Bruce Lee
the Bruce
challenge.
Lee challenge, all right? Can you take a 120-pound person from 67 Beacon Hill Road, whatever it is, to Baptist Hospital, in a recent amount of time?
And it's a dramatization, so, like, you can actually just put him in his classic yellow... Like
that's right.
Suit.
Yeah, that's right. He could have been the yellow tracksuit. He was, after all, discussing Game of Death supposedly on the day of his death.
Oh,
so.
Wow!
In his mind, he's wearing a yellow tracksuit on the day he died. Right. All right. What else we got?
All right. Next
I think
up,
we got time for one.
We got
more.
One more. All right. Next up, we got Officer Philosopher.
Okay.
I am a police officer who just started training Wing Chun. It is my understanding that Yip Man himself was a police officer at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Approaching martial arts through the lens of policing poses some very specific challenges.
Mm-hmm.
For example, an officer should strive to use only the amount of force reasonable and necessary, but all not so little force as to allow the arrestee to escape or cause harm.
Right. You always need to be slightly above the level of intensity of the person coming at you.
Okay. An officer must be able to perform sweeps and takedowns if necessary, but also resist them.
Yeah.
An officer must also keep their tools, baton, taser, firearm, at the ready and develop the hand speed to use them in an instant. Have you ever trained any officers? And do you think Wing Chun is well suited for this purpose?
So a couple things there. One, yes, Grandmaster Yip Man worked purportedly as a police officer in Fatan, but remember, Grandmaster Yip Man came from a wealthy family. So he's not, this isn't like, you know, this isn't Yip Man beat cop, all right? He's not there twirling his baton going like, you know, you're looking for trouble? Well, you found it, right? And this isn't him like Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock Yip solving murders in Fatan.
Sherlock hat.
Uh-huh. It was the Hong Kun guy with it. I can tell by these strokes here. This was a powerful Southern Chinese Kung Fu master who murdered this guy.
Man.
We have a Kung Fu serial killer on the lam, right? So, no, it wasn't like that at all. From what I understood, you know, Grandmaster Yip Man came from a wealthy family. Don't forget, he grew up in Fatan, but his family, they owned land. And his family was pretty wealthy. His family actually had businesses in Hong Kong.
Wow.
So imagine in the Qing Dynasty in the 1800s, you're so wealthy that you live in China and you have businesses in Hong Kong. And this is in the 1800s. So
are any still around?
I don't know. That's a good question. So Sivu Yip Man came from a well-to-do family, all right? Which is, I think, part of the reason why his family was maybe a little hesitant for him to learn martial arts at first, because... He came from kind of, let's say, the cultured class, and martial arts were maybe not always viewed as something that the cultured class did. You wanted to become a scholar or become learned or something like that, right? So he worked supposedly as a police officer, but I believe that this was more of a cushy job to keep him occupied, like to do something for fun.
So he wouldn't be bored, right?
Yeah, as opposed to him doing it because, you know, he needed, like, he's not part of the policeman's PBA union or whatever, like cashing in those checks for the benefits. You know what I mean? So I have heard, okay, don't shoot me. I'm just the messenger on this, that his job in the Hong Kong police, or sorry, in the Fatan police, or one of his jobs, or at some point, maybe he did other things. I don't know. There is the famous the story about someone trying to pull a gun on him, and he used his hand and he seized the revolver, and he kept the thing from turning, and the guy couldn't shoot the gun, and then he pulled it out. They actually did that in the first Yip Man movie, where he grabs the the revolver, right? Like this, and then pulls it up. So supposedly that's actually based on a real story. Now, how real is it? Who the hell knows, right? But apparently what I've heard is that his job was, he was kind of a glorified tax collector. And his job was to make sure that the prostitutes paid their taxes. So the prostitution being legal and a taxable occupation.
Wow.
They had to make sure that they, you know, paid their tribute or whatever to the government. So he was coming in, you know, and going to the houses of ill repute with an excellent reputation and collecting money.
If they didn't pay their taxes, how did he punish them?
I don't know about that. So anyway, in terms of Yip Man's tenure as a police officer, I you know, this isn't Sherlock Yip here, okay?
Okay.
So I wouldn't necessarily look to that as being part of our historical roots. Like Wing Chun has a deep history in being part of law enforcement or something like that. In Europe, in the EWTO, the European branch of the Leung-Ting Wing Chun organization from which I originally come, they taught a number of police officers, and including SWAT teams like SEK and GSG9, like the really elite SWAT teams. But they had a different program for them. So because obviously a police officer and even from a normal beat cop to like special units or special weapons and tactics, even like normal cop to special units versions have different requirements. So you can't just say, oh, police need this. A beat cop is restricted a lot more in a way that someone like on a SWAT team can do a lot more, right? So the training is not the same. So you can't put it all under the same general blanket of police training. Normal police versus, you know, SWAT team or SDU or in Hong Kong or SEK in Germany. SEK is Sondereinsatzkommando. That's one word. All right. Special duty commando or soldier, right?
Yeah.
And in Hong Kong, the SWAT team is the SDU, Special Duty Unit.
Wow.
In America, the SWAT, you know, Special Weapons and Tactics, that's SWAT is. So they have a very different type of training, and they train much more regularly. You don't really beat regular cops. They do their police academy training, and then maybe they have to do some firearm training to keep up on that. But from what I understand, for the most part, they don't have to keep up their hand-to-hand training. You learn what you learned in the police academy, and then they kind of send you off, right? Which is why you constantly see a lot of problems with violence and the ability to handle and restrain people. Well, I mean, a lot of them are dealing with very shoddy training, right? So I know from my time in Germany that the SEK and the SWAT teams, they learned Wing Chun, but it was a very special modified program taught by SEK and SWAT, German SWAT team instructors who were also Wing Chun instructors who focused on controlling techniques using some Wing Chun entries to basically get the guy to the ground and control them and pin them. Mm-hmm. And so, but while that uses Wing Chun ideas, the execution is very different and it's very modified. During my course in Germany, like one of the SEK instructors, he would come every now and again and he would teach us. And we had some SEK people training with us. And every once in a while, we had to do some SEK style training. So I learned some of that stuff, but I'm not a specialist in it. All right. Okay. Like we've done some of the things where like two people have to go and try to get this guy to the ground. We did some live training with that. And dude, that is not easy. All right, one person trying to control someone and get them and put handcuffs on them, whoa. Mm. But even two people, the guy can totally resist you. All you have to do is get the guy to the ground and get the cuffs behind them, right? Not easy, even if you kind of know what you're supposed to do because it's the unpredictability of people, the way they resist and stuff like that, right? So I've learned some of it, but one, I'm not a police officer, okay? Never worked as one. And two, I only dabbled in it during my formal Wing Chun training, like I did it a couple times. Mm-hmm. So I'm wholly underqualified to teach that program. And I would feel like a fraud teaching it because right. it's not my field, right? If I had a student that was a police officer, and by the way, I have taught many police officers, but they came to me just to learn Wing Chun, not to learn police Wing Chun. They just came to learn Wing Chun and I taught them. Also detectives and FBI and all that kind of stuff. But if I had a student that was really interested in like police tactic Wing Chun, like what they were doing in Germany, I'll probably take that student and send them to go learn the program from one of those guys, bring it back and have them teach it.
Okay.
Because that's your wheelhouse. I cannot, as a civilian and as someone who's just a kung fu nerd, tell people, uniformed officers, what they need for a job that I've never done. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that has to come from people who've actually done that. Otherwise, It's really not a good way to do it. And that's all I got to say about that. All right, Kung Fu Genius fans, I hope you like that episode. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius and hit that bell for notifications. If you have questions for a future episode for another AMA, go ahead and write them in the comments below. And as always, I'll see you guys next time. Word is I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your Kung Fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the victor. Two in a row in one take.
Is that good?
No, I think you could do that one again.
Yeah, there were a couple little pauses in there, but like you're definitely getting better. Yeah, so this podcast is almost over. This podcast was just an attempt to get you to be better at public speaking, and once it fulfills that requirement, suddenly you're gonna come in here one day and none of the stuff will be here. It'll be normal again. You're like, what's going on? I'll be like, what are you talking about?
That's the some podcast wild
and
plot.
And I'll be like, what podcast? What are you talking about?
Trey will be great as a public speaker. We just got to train him without him knowing.
What's the best way to do it? Let's make up this fake-ass podcast called The Kung Fu Genius. Yeah, 100%.